Welcome to episode number 96 of Pro Photo Show. One dramatic pause for music.
Welcome to Pro Photo Show, the resource for professional and enthusiast photographers, a member of the Blueberry Network and the Tech Podcast Network. For show notes, tips, forums, and more, visit us online at profotoshow.net.
Here we go. This is going to be a fun little ride tonight. We have a official three guest host panel tonight. With myself, Barry Hall, the one and only and longtime co-host of Pro Photo Show, Mr. Dennis Zerwas. Well played. And Mark Tetsky. Hello, Mark. Oh, wow.
Good evening, everybody.
You know, Mark was practicing that for a long time, so it is nice that you were ready to step up and join the party.
You know, well, that's not true, because it would have been much cooler if I would have actually practiced it.
You just need to decide what to wear in your suit tomorrow. We'll be good. All right. Well, this is just going to be kind of a fun little chat tonight. One of the topic of tonight's show is simply going to be what's in your bag. Now, if I was a super prepared guest host right now, I would actually have my camera bag here, but I don't. So we're just going to talk in theory more than anything. But it is a good topic to address, because as working photographers, we all get asked frequently by other photographers, by new photographers, and just by consumers, what kind of camera, what kind of lens, what kind of gear should I have for whatever. So we're going to start by just quickly kind of going around. I'll start just to kind of set it up a little bit and simply put, explain kind of my go-to bag. Now, I have other pieces of gear that are more specialized, but as a wedding portrait studio photographer that's very eclectic, do lots of team shooting, lots of school dances in addition to portraits in the studio, on location, weddings, events, all of that. I carry a Tenba bag that typically has a Nikon D600. I'll talk more about that in a minute. I have a good old Nikon D200 that I kick around as a second camera and use it only as needed, but it's still there anytime. With the D600, I basically run the trifecta of the lens ranges. I have my Nikon 14-24 2.8, which is phenomenal. I have a Nikon 50 prime, an 85 prime, the 7200 VR1, the original one. And then I also have the Tamron 24-70 2.8, which has VR. I chose that actually over the Nikon. The VR is really helpful for the kind of shooting I do, and it's been really good. Add a couple of speed lights, some various light modifiers, some wireless triggers, and that's pretty much my go-to setup. Obviously, we have monopods and tripods and all that kind of fun stuff. But that covers 90% of what I shoot. I have a 300-2.8 that I don't use much because I don't want to carry it around. But for certain sports, it makes sense to have. I think where a lot of photographers get themselves confused is they will perhaps watch an online workshop, Creative Live, perhaps read an article, see some photographer that creates some really beautiful image with a piece of equipment, and sometimes I think there's a tendency to run it. Well, I need that camera. I need that lens to make that image. Well, that's just maybe not always going to be the case. So I think just simplify things and then go from there, because what I shoot is very different from our next guest contributor here, Mr. Mark Tetsky, who lives in the world of architecture photography and it does an amazing job. So, Mark, when you pack up your bag to go out, what's your kind of go-to stuff?
Thanks, Barry. Well, and I think you hit across an important point. I think one of the biggest things that a person has to understand as a photographer, and especially a working photographer, is, you know, what's your style? What are you trying to shoot? Because what, you know, I have no use whatsoever for a 300 f2.8. I think it'd be fun. I'm sure I could find a way to use it if I bought it, but that's not something that really I had ever used in architecture. So, and, you know, I've bought things, plenty of things like a Lens Baby, in the past that I heard a lot of people talk about. I thought, wow, it's going to be really cool, and I couldn't stand it, so I sold it really quickly. And since then, I really came to understand what my style and what my genre of photography required. So that's an absolutely brilliant point. And make sure, you know, every time you buy a piece of equipment, just say, you know, is this something that is me that I am going to use? So, you know, there's lots of those out there. I would, you know, like fish eyes I have no use for or interest in. And there's a lot of stuff like that. So so what's in my bag? Starting with the bag itself, I don't shoot with bags. I'm a Pelican guy, so all my stuff rides around in a Pelican 1510 with Trek Pack inserts. That's T-R-E-K-P-A-K. I should probably post a link to that. I will later. They're amazing. It's kind of a modular insert system for Pelican cases and really lets you customize the inside of it to meet exactly what your loadout looks like. So starts with a Pelican case. I do carry a hip bag called a Boda bag, the Boda 3. It's a it's kind of a bat belt kind of a thing with it's a lens holder where you can put two lenses, a bunch of memory cards, a water bottle, a spare flash, and a bunch of other stuff. It's kind of the perfect thing to have on your hip when you're walking around a house all day, so you don't have to keep going back to your bag. So what's inside of those things? Well, for starters, the 5D Mark III is what I shoot everything with. I've got a 5D Mark II as a backup. You know, in architectural work, I know there's a lot of great architectural photographers doing it in the Nikon world, but I think, you know, the reason I went Canon is because of the tilt shift lens selection. Canon's got an exceptional tilt shift lens collection between the 17 tilt shift, the 24 tilt shift, the 45 tilt shift. You know, those three ranges covers about 99% of what you need to do in the architectural photography world. So that's why I shoot that. The Mark III, great dynamic range, also great resolution. And seriously, my favorite feature on that thing is actually the electronic bubble level. I know that's just horribly mundane, but that saves me 2 to 3 hours a week of not straightening images.
Cool.
So that's camera-wise. Lens-wise, I think I just touched on most of them. The lenses I go out with for an architectural shoot, I really only use two lenses. I use the Canon 17 tilt shift. Just a spectacular lens. That's one that really gets used in a, you know, like a residential, like a bedroom. If I want to show the whole bedroom, gets a little wide if you want to do it in a larger room, but if you want to show a bedroom or a bathroom or some kind of 10 by 10 room and show the whole room, that's the perfect lens to do that. The 24 gets used a lot. That's sort of the default architectural photography lens. Anytime you see a picture of a kitchen or something like that in a magazine, it's almost a guarantee that was shot with a 24. That's just sort of, that's the lens that gives you the look for architecture. And then rarely, I'll slap a 1.4x extender onto my 24 tilt shift to give me like a 40 millimeter tilt shift. That works, believe it or not. And the only reason I do that is because I don't actually own the 45 right now. And sometimes I need a little bit more oomph, especially when shooting exteriors. Mm-hmm. What else is in my bag? I've got there's a device that I really do rely on very heavily, couldn't live without. It's called the Promote remote control. It's a fairly expensive remote control that is actually very rugged and very feature rich. Canon cameras up until recently didn't have the ability to do more than 3-shot HDR brackets, and I typically do 5 to 7 shots. So the Promote allows me to automate that. I can program in exactly the sequence I want, how far apart things are, how quickly I want it to shoot, and just let her rip. It also does cool things like it does time lapses. It actually does video remote control. It does bulb ramping. It does HDR time lapses. And it does all these kind of great things that the camera doesn't do out of the bag. So that's something I use literally on every shoot. I also, I should grab this one because I knew I was going to forget the name of it. It's a little Wi-Fi remote control box that does live view remotely to your iPad. Sorry, I can't think of the name right now. I'll get back to that on that. But I do a lot of night shoots where I have to arrange a bunch of flashes, and I got to see what those flashes look like. So what I'll do is I'll arrange the flashes, I'll trigger the shot with my iPad, and I'll instantly get feedback on my iPad to what that what that looks like, and then be able to adjust a flash and get that all dialed in, all without having to go back to the camera, back out to where the flashes are, back to the camera, and so forth. And that's really the vast majority of what I use. Occasionally, I'll use a 17 to 40 with a polarizer on it or something like that if somebody's asking me to shoot a garden, but that's a rare occurrence. Aside from that, just a lot of different memory cards, cleaning supplies, little widgets that are used to solve problems once in a while. So I know we're going to get into cleaning and maintenance later on, so I'll table that portion of it till later.
All right, that is a good summation, and now we slide across into another part of the lovely Twin Cities. All three of us, by the way, are from the Twin Cities. We have had a wonderful winter, if you like snow, and lots of cold weather.
It got above freezing for the first time in 2 months here this week, and there were people walking around in short sleeve shirts. It was amazing.
It's a beautiful thing. So we go to Mr. Dennis Zerwas, and we start with the simple question, what's in your bag?
Well, I don't have nearly as many cool gadgets as Mark does. That's kind of his thing. But I've got the D700 is in my bag, and I've also got the D600, the 14 to 24, the 24 to 70, 70 to 200, basically that whole range of, from super wide to telephoto. I still have in there the 85 1.4, which I love for weddings. That's kind of like my go-to second camera body lens that I use. And then probably the lens I use the least and is the 50 1.4. With the ability to crank up the ISO on the cameras these days, you can get away with not having to use that 1.4, and especially at that focal length. It's just, that camera, that lens doesn't get out of the bag very much. Other than that, just the basic, like Mark said, cleaning supplies, cleaning cloths. I do have a couple of pairs of cowboy triggers, which have been mentioned on the show before, which everybody really enjoys and likes those. That's about it, really. That's super exciting.
No, that's more exciting than you think, actually. But now, let's just take that one little step further. One of the things that I guess I'm amazed at is how reckless I see a lot of photographers when I'm out and about where there's other photographers shooting. And this time of the year especially, I'm at a lot of sporting events. I recall the last podcast I believe I was on, I was walking around with a laptop at a hockey game because I was there to shoot it and paying attention to what was going on a little bit there as well. But when I'm there, I see frightening things. I see fans that have cameras that maybe their kid plays high school hockey, and of course in Minnesota hockey is a huge deal. It's like football in Texas. And I'll see a mom or a dad, but a lot of times I'll see a mom with a nice Nikon or Canon camera and a $1,500 or $2,000 fast zoom lens, and I'll see her take the sleeve of her coat and just to clean the front of the lens. And I see this kind of thing so often, it just absolutely drives me berserk. And so I guess I'd like for each of us just to contribute a little bit of kind of best practices, maybe is a good way to put it, of just sort of how we try and care and kind of take care of the equipment we have. And I'll start by saying that I'm sure a lot of my discipline goes back to the few decades that I shot. It seems like a long time when I say it like that. When I had all medium format, all Hasselblad gear, it truly was an investment when you bought a Hasselblad camera, when you bought another Hassi lens. They were very expensive. They treated you very well. They lasted virtually forever. And for a long period of time, they actually appreciated in value, which was a really neat trick in the camera system building days of my career. My first camera I bought, $1,200. Signed, sealed, and delivered. I was working for a camera store at the time. Got a little discount. That was body, lens, back, and prism. I sold that camera several years later for $1,800. Basically made $600 on a camera that I used for 8 or 10 years, which obviously that doesn't happen anymore. But throughout that deer building time of my early career, I really treated my gear really, really well. Dennis can attest to that. Back in the day when we just, the Hasselblad bags, they were perfect. We really made sure lens caps and all that kind of stuff. And nowadays it's a little different, because if you're going to invest in the best gear, the best glass, the best cameras, granted, they don't last maybe the 10 and 20 years always that we used to be able to get. That doesn't matter anymore. The fact of the matter is that if anything, we have to treat this stuff more delicately, because it's more delicate. We have lenses with computer chips inside them. We have cameras that are more electronic than they are anything else. So we have to be so cognizant of moisture and dust and grit and grime and temperature and all that kind of stuff. One thing that I stumbled across that is a really, really nifty thing is, I think I mentioned one other time before, Zeiss makes a lens cloth, a moistened lens cloth that you can buy literally at Walmart. It's a box about this big. It's very inexpensive. They're like wet wipes. I mean, they're literally individual package thing. When they say Zeiss on them, you got to know you're in pretty good shape to start there. I actually talked to an optical engineer, who's the guy that got me turned on to those. They use those things to clean Zeiss microscopes, because he happens to work for Zeiss. You know, microscopes that literally are like close to $1 million, and they're using those wipes. So I feel pretty good with those. They're fantastic, because they're sort of an alcohol-based feeling kind of thing. You know, you open them up, you use them. I use that now as my moistening cloth. They're inexpensive, they're individually packed, and then I go back with the regular lens, tissues or cloths, whatever that I have, to dry as needed and so on. But just to keep my lenses really, really clean. One of the power user tips I'll throw in on this conversation, because, again, I'm a guy out there in the winter that shoots a lot, where I'm indoors and outdoors and outdoors and indoors and moving gear back and forth. If you ever get into a situation where you have moved your gear from being cold to inside where it's warm and or perhaps humid, then if your lenses start to fog up, if there is a hand dryer in a restroom in that building, get to it. Take your lens caps off. You'll look like an idiot. People will think you're kind of crazy, but that is a remarkable way. You're never going to wipe all that moisture off. I actually had to do that just a week ago. I had to go from shooting a basketball game to a swim meet, and it was one of those days that was 24 below or whatever. And even in that short time that I just went from gym to truck, short drive, so nothing really got warmed up, into the pool, I walked into that very humid swimming pool, and everything was just fog city. And, it would be pointless to try and wipe that moisture off, because it'll just keep coming back. I spent probably 3 or 4 minutes in with the hair dryers, which in a swimming pool, they're super high. I'm gonna hang on. It was great. Then I was able to go out and complete my shoot. So those are just a couple things there. And then beyond that, I think that one of the things that I would like to encourage lots of people is, especially with the lenses, everything from, I'm amazed how many times I hear and know of photographers that have to send lenses back into a manufacturer because they aren't focusing right. And I think part of that comes to not necessarily that they were cared for poorly, but I do think that our lenses are in general a little bit more delicate than they ever used to be. So I think it makes a lot of sense to have them in padded bags or cases and not be banging them around certainly more than we need to. So those couple of, things would perhaps be good. So, obviously fresh batteries and chargers and, all the dilemmas that you can run into. One thing I learned a long time ago from somebody, and I use it across a lot of different applications, but is to constantly be kind of asking yourself the question, what can possibly go wrong? When you're preparing for that shoot, when you're packing your gear, do you have a packing list? A lot of people say, it's ridiculous, you don't need that. Well, I think you do, because it's amazing. We've all had to improvise at one point or another, but a little bit of preparation goes a long way. Decide what you need. Decide what gear you need. Decide how you want to use it. and then make sure you have everything you need. And you know, I have a little little plastic stool with that you open up a little tray in it that is with me at virtually all our shoots for teams and dances and all those kinds of things that we do. And it's just loaded with miscellaneous, you know, a handful of different screwdrivers and all sorts of little tape and knives and, you know, all sorts of little widgets and gadgets of things that, if necessary, you know, wrenches and things to tighten up legs and tripods and all that kind of stuff. Because there's nothing worse than getting somewhere, setting up, having a piece of equipment break or something not work right, and then not be able to really deal with it. So those are just kind of a few of my little tidbits. I guess we'll stay in the same order for now, Mark. Any thoughts you have on, do you do anything special? I suppose your stuff really, really matters in terms of clean glass.
Oh, you'd think that, wouldn't you? I have actually been testing to see the limits of how much you can not do these things and took good results over the course of this year.
Okay.
So Barry's absolutely right. You know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure for sure. I just got my 5D Mark III back from the mothership after my USB port wore out because my USB cable for my promo tugged on it one too many times. And that's, you know, that $500 it took to repair, I would have rather not have spent.
Ouch.
But, you know, that's when you're in a business, you have tools, and tools break sometimes. So, you know, I've got a good friend that's an electrician, and he's got the funniest looking hammer. It's got, you know, it's a fiberglass hammer, and the shaft on it literally is only about that big around now. The rest of it's so worn off. He's hit it against so many things over the lifetime of this hammer that it's his favorite hammer. It's now nice and light. It's still, he uses it all the time, but you can see that the hammer's been well-loved and it's served him well through over the course of the career. And that was just a good reminder to me that, you know, these aren't things to set on your mantle. They're tools, and tools wear and, you know, take care of them and they last a lifetime, but they do wear. So, you know, the big problem I have with dust typically, you know, keeping my lenses clean on my tilt shifts is that there are these things called overhead lights, you know, these overhead cans that are right on top of you. And a lot of times they're right inside the front door, so or right inside the door. So if you're set up in the perfect place to take a room, you've also kind of got that overhead can light kind of at that perfect angle to cause lens flare. And normally that's not so bad, but if you've got a little bit of dust sitting on your front element on that one, every one of those just kind of lights up and twinkles on that shot. So I can see instantly that if I start getting the twinklies as I'm editing, that it's time to maybe clean that front element a little bit more. I've also been finding the limits on what to do in winter photography. I've been doing all the photography and videography for Blizzard Ski and Snowboard Club this winter. And that essentially involves skiing around all day, carrying a video monopod with a video camera on it, an EOS M, and a 5D Mark II with the 70 to 200 on it as I'm skiing all day long in the snow in sub-zero weather. And, condensation's a real issue with that one. So I've gotten real good about cleaning lenses, warming things back up again, managing snowfall and so forth. And it's worked well. I've been out skiing all winter long and, you know, knock on woods, no serious wipeouts yet. And my equipment's been absolutely awesome all winter long as a result. So special tips and tricks, you know, again, I mentioned this in a recent episode and I'm a little late to the party on this one, but lens pen is really a lifesaver, you know, just for using the whiskey end to whisk off those little twinklies that get on the end of your glass, using the carbon end to wipe the fingerprints off after you're done with a lens wipe or something like that afterwards. It really helps keep things going. But I also admit I've used the sleeve of my polar fleece once or twice as well.
That's all right. Better your polar fleece than someone else's polar fleece.
That's a good point. It does work remarkably well for removing dust.
Yeah.
Well, Dennis, what's your two cents
worth on that? Imagine this. Mine's a lot like yours because that's early on shooting Hasselblad. I learned a lot of the tips and tricks from you. That was like 17 years ago. So way that you cared for your gear, I also do the same thing, still, obsessively. I'm a big fan of putting caps, both lens, the front element caps and the back caps on when lenses aren't in use. again, it's just having a nice, orderly, neat bag so that when you get a call to do a job, you've got everything ready to go. Even more exciting is if the Northern Lights or something is out or something out of nowhere comes up, you're able just to run and grab and you're not dealing with caps and all over the place, lenses all on their side. You've got, you know, smudges everywhere. So I'm a little obsessive that way. One thing I have noticed, it seems like with the new kind of breed of photographers, it seems like, and maybe it's just because I've gotten older and more used to using the gear like a tool. But it seems like you get these photographers who buy a camera and they're afraid to use it, you know, which sounds silly, but they're afraid to put shutter clicks on it. They're afraid to, you know, even take it out in a light mist, which, you know, we all three of us were out on retreat on the rocks up on the North Shore, and that weather, well, you're going to test the weather seal on some of your cameras. That is one event where, but it's fun to see a group of 5, 7, 8 guys who just are out there and their stuff's getting soaked or wet. And yeah, you're at that. You're walking a fine line, but you can tell that there are people. Those are photographers who are using the tools as they were meant to be used, and that's creating pictures in that kind of environment. And as far as the camera goes, once you start to see the dust start to show up on some of the portraits or whatnot, especially this time of year, if you're out doing outdoor shooting and it's very white, you know, with all the snow, it's really easy if you do get up into that the smaller f-stop, is you start to see a lot more dust. And then that's usually when I decide to, you know, first I'll run the auto clean on the camera. And then if they don't, you know, usually they don't, aren't affected by some of the bigger gobs, you need to go in there. And yeah, the lens pen's great. And I have one of those, like a rocket blower. So it all depends on how nasty it is. But yeah, otherwise I've always got a microfiber cloth in the bag, or two, or three, or four. No, and that way it's just, you've got something always nice to have that in there, even just to take fingerprints off of the gear, which sounds silly, but you know, it's all about presentation, really. So if you're working in close contact with customers and they see you've got a, you know, hacked up dirty piece of gear, I don't know, not how I roll, but you know, if that's what you want to do,
you know, and well. I think you bring up a valid point here too. This, you know, pro level gear is meant to take a punch or two, you know, and it will survive a lot more than people think they do. And you know, down to little things like putting UV filters to protect the front element. I've shot about 450,000 shots without a UV filter in there, and I have no scratch front elements. So, mm-hmm. Use your lens hoods. And you know, if something does hit it, that's the cheapest part of the lens to replace, mm-hmm. and it probably isn't that much more expensive than the UV filter you're putting on it. So, you know, get out there and use your camera, people. It's not to sit on your mantle.
And I'm glad you actually brought up lens hoods, because that's a pet peeve of mine, that I just don't see a reason not to have a lens hood on a lens. There are so few situations where it ever even warrants not having a lens hood on. And I'm amazed at the number of shooters I see that just don't bother with them. They never put them on. They just don't use them. They think they get in the way. But boy, you know, a lens hood, not only does it just block extraneous light from hitting the front element of the lens, which is kind of important. If you want flare, God bless you, go for it. But, you know, most customers sort of anticipate a relatively clear, sharp image. It's kind of what they're paying us for. But I had a situation where, to what Mark had mentioned about a lens hood, I was hired to shoot an event. It was a Disney on Ice event, and they were recognizing a guest who had not missed a Disney on Ice in like 20-some years in Minneapolis. No comment, but this is what we do. And so this gentleman is being presented with some sort of a lifetime pass for Disney on Ice, and the Disney people, you know, were going to hype this up and all of that. Well, the wires got crossed a little bit when the event was being scheduled, and the phone call came that, hey, where are you? You need to be here now, as opposed to, well, gee, I have it down that it starts in 3 hours or whatever. So it was a very, very quick drive to downtown Minneapolis, throwing my gear together in, you know, in the truck as I'm driving, knowing that I'd have no time when I got there. Well, I pulled in, double parked, ran in through the security entrance because I knew my way around Target Center where the event was being held, went around the back hallway. It's very disturbing to see those chipmunks without their heads on, by the way. I'm not going to lie. And as I raced down the hallway, I figure, well, I can see where the stage kind of through the curtains is set up, so I'm going to duck in and kind of come from backstage, and I should be able to find where these people are and that. Well, in my haste to get down the dark hallway in the backstage, I hit ice where I wasn't expecting ice quite so soon. I was thinking hallway to the ice. So I hit ice, and I had my own little Disney on ice moment, and it was my I think it was a D300 at the time that I brought with me down there with a 80, you know, with a, I don't know, short wide-angle zoom of some kind, Nikon zoom with the lens hood on, and a flash, and that was all just in hand. Well, I kind of hit right elbow down. I smashed down pretty hard. The camera and lens kind of crashed forward on the ice. This all happened, of course, in a split second. The lens hood shattered. I mean, shattered is the best way to put it. The lens, I kind of gathered myself up. My cell phone went sliding across the ice, you know, because that was in my other hand, and that just off it went to the other side of the rink. And I quickly kind of gathered myself, saw this destroyed lens hood, and took the remaining broken piece off. Looked at the lens, it seemed like it still turned and focused and everything. The flash kind of was like, it wasn't pretty. And so I took the flash off. I took the pieces of the lens hood that were there. There was a little shelf right there, stuck it all on the shelf, hit the pop-up flash to make sure it worked, went out, and no sooner do I get out there and they say, oh, because of traffic, we're delaying everything about 45 minutes. Well, long and the short of it was, camera was fine, lens was fine, flash was now a special edition duct-tape version like this. No more of that anymore. When I, you know, stopped in my local camera store to buy another lens, so that's one thing that, you know, first thing the guy said was, well, be happy you're a Nikon shooter, because it was like $17, and the comparable Canon hood is, you know, $45 or something. So I enjoyed that little moment, but it was a very inexpensive piece of insurance. Yeah, well, it is. And so, and without that lens hood, there's no doubt in my mind I would have destroyed that lens. And if not ruined it, would have cost hundreds of dollars in repairs. So, yeah, a little bit prevented. I also have a sensor scope to analyze or evaluate dust on my sensor. And it's nothing more than a lighted magnifier that fits right onto the body of your camera. You push the little button. We had it retreated in the rocks when everybody kind of passed their cameras around. And when you put that little light on with that magnifier, you can really see what's on your sensor. Then just use the little rocket blower and deal with that. But I want to talk about dust spots for a second, because
Barry, who had the cleanest sensor,
had goobers, and
who had the cleanest sensor.
Right. Well, everybody had a clean something that day.
I think the word pristine was uttered.
Pristine, yes, that's right. It was pristine. Mark. Of course, it had a USB port hanging out the side that was all gangly.
Don't pay attention to that. Focus on the pristine sensor.
Fortunately, USB ports don't affect image quality.
That's very true. With my Nikon D600, the D600, many of you know, has been plagued by a oil spot problem that doesn't affect all D600s, but appears to have affected more than Nikon probably wanted to admit originally. And, you know, there's two ways to evaluate a sensor. Obviously, you can look at it. A lighted magnifier is a terrific way to look at it. But really, the proof is in the image. And so, you know, there's nothing better than a bright overcast sky. Take a picture, as Dennis said, at a small aperture, at f11, at f16. I prefer to underexpose that a stop and a half or two. Then you're going to really see what's there. And so I just went through this exercise in the D600, and, you know, there are some spots that I'm just curious about more than anything, and I kind of took advantage of Nikon's jumpiness right now over this. There's kind of some attorney gathering, you know, information for a possible class action lawsuit. It's gotten pretty large. So I figured this was as good a time as any to go ahead and contact Nikon. They sent me a prepaid 2-day shipping label, send my camera in, so I shipped it off today. I have no idea whether I have the oil spots or not, or if I just have some goobers on that sensor that I just haven't, you know, been able to clean off, because I've never used any kind of swab of any kind. But what my understanding is that they are, you know, they're being pretty aggressive on replacing the shutter mechanism, which seems to be where the oil spots came from. So if nothing else, I'll get a camera back probably with a new shutter, and that'll take my click count back to zero, which is good because I put a lot on them. In some cases, I think they've actually replaced them with a newer model, the D610. And the reality is that even people that have, you know, have lenses, I know of one guy. He had a camera, got one lens, mounted one lens on there, and thought that would prevent him from ever having a dust problem. And, you know, takes a trip, comes back with some beautiful images, and what does he have? Goobers in the sky. And he's like, how is that even possible? I never took the lens off the camera. It's a new era. We just have dust enters our systems, I think, at a lot of levels. So, and to Dennis's point with lenses and lens caps, it's amazing. I clean the back of my lenses as much as I clean the front glass. I clean the front glass, the rear glass, and then I clean around the mount itself. Because just camera, you know, on, off, bag, lens cap, stuff just gets, you know, not grimy, but foreign material can build up there. And
have any of you seen that that post by Lens Rentals or one of the rental companies about returned gear that was used at a color run?
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's this phenomenon called color runs where for some unknown reason people think it's fun to go run a 5K as clouds of smoke, colored smoke, are being poured on you. And I don't
it's
know.
For,
I
think, it's for a good cause, Mark. It raises awareness for emphysema.
I think, yes, and causes it at the same time.
Oh,
but, hey. Really, seriously, I mean, when you see what that does to a lens, I mean, they've taken apart lenses, and these are on weather-sealed lenses. They're showing how much dust is actually reaching all of the interior elements. They basically had to, they've had to total out a few lenses because so much dust gets inside these weather-sealed lenses.
Yep.
You know, as you're focusing these lenses, especially the zoom lens, there are things moving in and out. And when things have to move out and get longer and shorter, it's going to huff some air in and out of there. So even if it's sealed, that thing's not waterproof. And some air is going in, and it's eventually going to breathe some dust inside it. So kind of no such thing as a completely sealed system when it comes to lenses and cameras.
I think it's just important to know where you're at with your gear. And, you know, something as simple as cleaning the sensor can save you so much aggravation in post-production. All right, you guys take this a second. I'm going to find something for my dog to entertain herself. Hang on. Go.
Put on Sister Act 2. That's a classic. I don't think his dog watches movies anymore.
That works in keeping his dog busy. I'm going to actually bring a copy of Sister Act 2 when I go shoot homes with people's dogs in there that follow me around.
That's going to be weird, Mark.
I can just sort of drag him into an office, shut the door, and hope they don't trash the place.
There's a guy making a dog watch Sister Act 2. Spoiler alert. Does Barry want us to keep talking about photography?
He wasn't very specific on that one, is it? So we're kind of down to like third and fourth banana here, so I think, well, the cat's away, the mice shall play.
All right, what are we doing? What do we want to talk about? We can talk about the Aurora? Nah.
Hey, have you seen some of the spectacular photos from around Lake Superior from last night?
This is I just saw our good buddy Bill.
That was unbelievable. That's an unbelievable
shot.
Picture.
Is fantastic, and he deserves some props for that. I'll have to put a link to that. It's in the Great Lakes Aurora Hunters and a few other Facebook groups that he posted it in, and it's a great, phenomenal shot. And it goes to prove something that I've said for as long as I can remember. When it comes to Aurora pictures, it's one thing to get a really great display of aurora picture, you know, of aurora in the sky, but the other half of that is the settings, the surroundings. What do you put in the foreground?
You got to have context,
because there's nothing. If it's just a farm field and some trees, that's cool. But it's amazing what happens when you actually think, you know, kind of think ahead and put things in the foreground. Or like our buddy Bill did, he was inside of one of the like Apostle caves. Is that what it was?
Yeah, just Apostle Island ice caves.
And he was shot it from inside there, and it's just framed beautifully. And you've got some of the pine trees off to the right, and it's just a great shot. So, Barry, we started talking about aurora just because we talked about Sister Act 2, dogs, watching Sister Act 2 to keep them busy, and then we moved into aurora and mentioned Bill's shot. So now you're up to speed.
And honestly, Bill is the big shout out to Bill here. I don't know if he's listening tonight or not, but. Bill is the textbook example of how'd you get that great shot? F8 can be there. Every single day when it snows, that guy is posting new shots from that morning at 7:30 in the morning. I swear, he sets his alarm, looks outside, any interesting weather today? Yes, I'm going out. So I swear that guy's out shooting every single morning. So, and, you know, it paid off yesterday. He was up there and the aurora nuked itself and he was in an amazing place to shoot it. And, you know, he's got an amazing shot to show for it.
I'll put that in the chat so we can throw that in the show notes, too. What's next? What's going on?
All right. Now, here's an interesting question. And again, I can't believe I don't have a camera with me here to demonstrate this. So, Dennis, you are the demonstrator. So, you have to grab your camera. Got a camera?
Dennis? I have an iPod from 1995, which is not even true. It didn't exist. Here's a camera. Do you need a lens on it?
Yes.
Oh, I ain't got no lens on it. How about just a lens?
Don't forget to take the lens cap off first.
I'm seriously missing a camera. It's not. No, I know. It's in a different bag. All right. So you got your camera here.
Okay. And this is just a fun little question and a fun little exercise. We're just gonna have a little discussion here.
You gonna make me do a selfie online? Yep.
No, kind of.
You're gonna drop another guide number knowledge bomb on everybody, are you?
No guide numbers, nothing like that.
Okay. I've got the D700 here with the grip.
When you go to take a picture,
yes.
Do you look through the camera with your left or your right eye?
I look through it with my this eye, so that's my right eye.
Okay. All right, Mr. Teske, are you a right eye or two?
Right eye.
Okay. Right eye.
Does anybody see the problem in my demonstration?
Lens cap, but other than that, it's great. And it's a
mirrorless camera.
And it's a mirrorless camera with no viewfinder. There is no viewfinder.
Oh, well played. Oh, he's like a wizard.
Yes.
But it's the only one I had handy.
Actually, I do have my heel. Okay, well, here's why I bring up this discussion. This has been an interesting, I wouldn't call this a debate. This is just a preference thing that some people like what they like. And here's my little EOSM. So there we go. The kit lens on at the moment.
Hey, how about you?
Yeah. Hey, there we go. Hey, woo, thanks, Mark.
Holla.
Exactly.
I don't have left out. Hey.
Okay. Now, here's where I'm going with this. It certainly doesn't matter if your camera has a viewfinder.
Just play along. It does. It's a prop.
It's a prop. It doesn't matter if you use your left or your right eye. This isn't a test of what is right or what is wrong. I posted this out on one of the photography, kind of a Minnesota photographers group. It just kind of got some input from some folks, and it was really split. I would say it was about half and half, although I would say more people use their right eye. Many of them don't know why they use their right eye other than they're right-handed and they do everything with their right, everything, and so it just seems logical. Many moons ago, I was at a camera workshop of sorts, and there happened to be an engineer from Ricoh. Now, Ricoh was at the time trying to roll into the – they were trying to become a serious player in the then film SLR industry, which was dominated by same kind of cast of characters, Canon, Nikon, Minolta was still a big player, Olympus was out there. Pentax, and that was about it. And, you know, you had other brands, but they had the lion's share of the market. Well, Ricoh was trying to really break in, and so they had some interesting SLRs that were actually really well made, titanium bodies before anybody else did, and some interesting things. But I got kind of in a sidebar discussion because most of the people at this particular event weren't really photographers. They were people in the photo finishing industry and didn't really know anything about cameras necessarily. I was that guy who was very curious because here we got a, this guy came from Japan. I mean, he's an engineer that helps design cameras. And I got into that discussion with him, and I asked him, I said, was there ever any rhyme or reason as to the placement of a viewfinder in an SLR body and whether left or right eye was intentioned? He says, absolutely, in his opinion anyway, that many of the design engineers felt that from early on, the placement of where the viewfinder with the mirror and all of that, and then SLRs, and it's pretty much in the same location on most DSLRs, that it was designed a little bit more for the left eye than the right eye, where that was possible. And the logic being simply this. If you use your left eye behind the camera, when you pull the camera up to your face, viewfinder, remember, pretend again, that your right eye is somewhat naturally shielded by the back of the camera and your right hand, which you don't have to open it, or you don't have to close your eye, rather. And Dennis, your demonstration was perfect. As soon as you put that camera up, it was this. It's that squint of that eye to keep that eye closed. Now, there are people that can shoot with both, but when you do that with your right eye, that left eye really hangs in space. I kind of found myself, I happen to be a left eye guy. That's just how I was shooting originally. And then it made sense, because whether it's vertical or horizontal, there's a natural break, and I never, ever, ever shut that second eye. So it allows me to see the flash going off. It allows me to have some bit of peripheral vision when I'm shooting sports to see what's coming, you know, whatever it happens to be. And, you know, when I've shot a lot of the sporting events where some of the pro shooters have been, it's been interesting to watch. And there are, again, they're even split half and half, but I can't imagine when I'm shooting a long event, whether it's a hockey game or a soccer game, a state tournament game or something, you know, having to keep that eye closed for long periods of time, it's just a lot of muscle strain. So I guess my power user tip would simply be try it both ways. If you're a right eye guy and you can't do anything but right eye, keep shooting with the right eye. And it's fine. I mean, you can make it work. Many, many people certainly do. But you might be surprised if it doesn't really bother you. And I've heard people that say you have to, you know, whatever your dominant eye is should be the eye. Well, that maybe was more true when we were manually focusing all our cameras. I'm not really sure that matters that much. You could probably make a case either way. But, you know, if nothing else, just put the camera out at arm's length, turn it a little bit, it'll naturally turn the right direction. Kind of look through that viewfinder with your left eye, leave your right eye open, slowly bring the camera up to your face. You might be surprised how easy it really is to look through that viewfinder, not have to close that eye. And you might have, I met one photographer who really got me thinking about this again recently at a hockey game, who was complaining that the guy came up to me and said, do you ever get migraines when you take pictures? I'm like, no. I said, do you? He goes, yeah, I do. He said, almost every time I shoot, I get migraines, and it's the only time I get it. So as I watched him, boy, he had that.
He had the power squint going.
Oh, it was unbelievable. And so we had this discussion, and he was like, well, I could never use my left eye. I said, are you sure? And we did that a little bit, and then he tried to actually shoot. And I saw him actually do it, but, you know, he kept going back to his right eye, of course, right away. And it's just a thought. I mean, it's one of those things that, you know, when you think about how important ergonomics are in life now, with how chairs are designed and computers and laptops and keyboards and everything else, if we're behind our cameras a lot, I mean, personally, I feel like with my left eye, I feel like I get a more natural kind of tripod of my arm, you know, whereas with the right, it just seems like things turn away from me a little bit more. But I'm always thinking, what's comfortable? What gives me rock solid camera handling? I've always been a big fan of get steadier than you think you need to be. I don't care if you have VR lenses or not. Vibration reduction is a great tool. It's not a crutch. You know, it doesn't mean you can, you know, be jumping around like you're in an earthquake and be saved by your VR all the time. So it always makes sense. Camera supports. Mark, that camera support you showed me up at Retreat on the Rocks, the little goofy deal with the feet. What a great little device that is.
Think you're muted. Do the mime thing where you're stuck in a box again.
There he's back.
You know, fighting against a hard wind. Let me do that other
time. Oh, there we go. Boy, who knew he was so skilled at the mimage on this show?
That was weak. Very weak.
Well,
show.com.
So what Barry's talking about actually is, this has been the device that I've used for all my skiing, all the video work I'm doing on skiing, is I've got a Manfrotto. Let me look up the number here quick. I've got a Manfrotto video monopod. And honestly, it's for video, but I don't know why this wouldn't be awesome for doing stills as well. Video monopod, it's the 5-6. Wait a minute. They just actually changed the model number. It was 561 BHDV or something like that. Now it's the MVM500A. They just changed it. It's a normal monopod, but what it has, it's got a pan head on top of it, and it's got a little chicken foot thing on there. So what you're doing is you're getting, another degree of stability on that thing, and you're getting the ability to use a monopod and pan the thing and do some kind of natural motions. It's amazing how much more stable that makes just a little, you know, the video that you're doing. Just even putting it on that stick makes it much more stable than you think it would be. What I also found out, kind of an interesting side thing, is if you take that monopod and scrunch it up to kind of its shortest length, which is still probably 24 inches long, it sort of works as a pseudo steady cam. So I'll actually follow people off of jumps in the terrain park, just kind of holding it at the top and letting it ride really loosely, and it'll totally steady cam the thing as I'm skiing down the hill, and I'll actually get some very, very stable video as a result from that. So extremely useful tool. It's about $279 right now at B&H. And honestly, that's the most valuable camera support thing I've got right now for doing video, because it's useful in so many circumstances. And it's quick, which is also very important.
And I'm amazed at I had somebody recently contact me, knows of me as a wedding photographer. She's a fairly young shooter. Has done a few weddings and can't understand why ceremony pictures just aren't really very sharp. And so she sent me some files and I said, well, are you using a tripod? No. Are you using a monopod? No. Why not? Well, my camera goes up. I can put my camera ISO up to 25,600. I said, I'm sure you can. That's not helping you. It's interesting because, this particular photographer fought two things. The pictures that were sharp, you'd never know it because the ISO was so far beyond the usable range of that sensor that even if the image was sharp from a steady standpoint, there was so much digital noise from an insanely high ISO that it didn't matter. And the shots where the ISO was back down in a more normal range, there just was too much camera movement and a zoom lens and, not even a 2.8 type zoom, probably a variable f4, 5.6 type, zoom lens. So it's like, boy, you're just fighting. Back to the original discussion of what's in your bag. You don't have the right gear to shoot anything like what you're trying to shoot. And to that point, that's probably another thing that I am somewhat amazed that many photographers simply don't know what the maximum usable range of their ISO is on their camera. But forget what it goes up to. That's pointless. That's an irrelevant feature set in the spec of your camera. As my progression through Nikon DSLRs has gone, with each generation of camera comes significant bumps. Probably the biggest jump, Dennis, was when you first got the D700. And I remember you sending me a picture of some candles from a wedding or something, and you shot it at, ISO 3200 or whatever. And that was just mind blowing because the cameras prior to that, that we were all using, really 800 was the absolute top you could live with. And so now it's like D700 was a new benchmark. Canon, has had similar kinds of success at different, camera levels. But, not talking about video, I don't really know I can't really address that. Yeah. I'm not speaking to that. But for still imagery, you have to know what you're dealing with. And as the sensors get larger and better, you go to a 24-meg full-frame sensor or larger, you are going to put more pressure on the quality of the glass you hang in the front of it.
Yeah, and, you know, being a 5D Mark III shooter, a lot of what, you know, what's the effective usable ISO on my camera really has a lot to do with what I'm shooting. Mm-hmm. What's an effective usable ISO in an event type situation is wildly different than what's acceptable for an architectural shot. An architect, you know, most of the stuff I shoot in architectural photography, I shoot at ISO 200. I don't shoot at 100. Honestly, I can't tell the difference in the shots, and the 200s go by a little bit quicker because, remember, I'm shooting HDR brackets and I can't wait around all day. So, you know, that's one case, whereas, you know, if I'm shooting an event, actually I get a pretty good image out of ISO 6400. But it breaks down really fast after that. You know, ISO 12.8, you know, ISO 8000 and ISO 12.8 get ugly pretty quick. So, you know, 6400 is pretty clean, but I know that's pretty much the usable line for me, even though it goes much, much higher.
And I think the point being, we have a lot of people that are trying to kind of sow their oats in this industry professionally that haven't had the opportunity yet to make the jump into a kind of a pro-level kind of camera body. And so they're using a crop sensor camera that, you know, that, again, if you've spent less than $1,000 for your camera body, there's a pretty good chance that anything over ISO, probably $1,000, is going to be a stretch. It may be okay for certain situations, but if you're hanging your line on it and you're trying to do this professionally, boy, I tell you what, it's just, you just need to know what that range is and then deal with it accordingly. I mean, I think back, again, back to the medium format days, we shot, you know, the old Vericolor 160 and the Pro 160 film, which really wasn't even 160. We all shot it at ISO 120, and then we'd put a handful of rolls of 400 speed film for ceremony shots. Ooh, I know. And then the Fuji 800 speed film came out that was marvelous, and, you know, so we got to use that. But honestly, even when I was using the Fuji 800 as my standard film, I always kept some of the 160/120 speed rolls because the 800 was too fast. There were times I wanted that slower film for certain things and, you know, for be a shallow depth of field and, you know, whatever other kinds of things. So it's all about using the tools properly. And I think that's probably where today's gear has robbed a lot of people of ever having to think about their gear and what's in their bag, because they just get a camera and a kit lens or two and a zoom and off they go. And they don't really know why they're using what they use. They don't know why sometimes they like their zoom this way and sometimes they like it that way. They don't really know the difference. They just kind of play and shoot. And I think everybody could benefit from stepping back a little bit. And, you know, I go back to the early days and remember working in the camera stores where we'd look at those lens, you know, those posters that we always had up of all the Nikon and all the Canon lenses from this one all the way through. And, okay, we all sat there and kind of lusted over this, you know, array of glass going, boy, it feels so intimidating because we have these four and they have like 37 lenses, you know, in the picture. But there's a time and a place for all of it. Zooms have gotten so much better now where, you know, there was that years ago, and I guess I'd throw this out there for some of the newer shooters. If you talk to somebody who's been shooting for 20 years or more, don't be shocked if they're kind of anti-zoom lenses, because, frankly, for a long time, zoom lenses just weren't really the caliber of what you got with your primes. And back in the film days, boy, most people that shot a lot of serious film systems that they had, you know, in their bag, they had a 20 and a 24 and a 28 and a 35 and a 50 and an 85 and, you know, all the way up. They just didn't trust the optical performance of a lot of the zooms. And there weren't a lot of high-end zooms at that time, and that game has certainly changed. So I guess anything else on any of that topic that either of you guys want to kind of throw in on the comment section there, or do we move on?
You know, I do have a little bit of a tale on that topic today about, you know, tripods and stability and image quality. I worked a trade show today and had a booth there, and
I was showing off my goods to real estate agents and so forth, and one of my competitors was there. And to be fair, you know, they're in a different niche than I am, and they're serving a different market than I am. They're in a more commodity market, whereas I'm in a higher end artistic type of market. And as I was talking to her, she said, "Yeah, they're really high end like you. You know, they use tripods and stuff."
That's how we talk about you. He's so high end, he's using tripods and stuff.
Deer in the headlights. Like, your photographers don't use tripods? I'm like, I got nothing for you. Yeah. I have one more to go with that.
Yep. Well, yeah, and back to the discussion I was having with this one, you know, young gal. You're clearly showing an interest in creating better images for her clients. But when I started to explain it, you know, kind of my methodology with that, you know, I kind of got the eye roll and the, oh, there's no way. I would never want to bring that much stuff with me. I'm a passionate shooter. I have to be in the moment. I can't be dragging all this gear and worrying about where it is. Well, okay, maybe there's some valid, you know, validity to that too. But, boy, I just can't imagine not being really properly equipped for anything you're going to shoot. We've all been there where we've been maybe engaged in or hired to shoot a job where we just didn't have quite the right stuff with us, perhaps. You know, it's, you know, sometimes we have to scramble, but you need to avoid scrambling, and then you also need to say, and the internet now, this internet thing, Dennis, I think it's here to stay. I'm pretty sure it's going to stick around.
No, some people told me it was just a fad. So.
Okay, the interweb. And it's fascinating to me that as easy as it is to learn, like we were playing around up at our little retreat on the rocks with this Brenzier effect, which is, we won't spend a lot of time on that, but it's basically shooting multiple frames, merging them all together, and basically getting I think Mark put it best, you're getting an impossible depth of field.
You're creating an impossible lens. You're getting, right. You know, in short, you know, you're getting an ultra wide field of view, and the wider you get, the more kind of infinite depth of field your lens has. So, mm-hmm. You know, ultra wide lenses, you don't have to focus them really because of the fact just about everything's in focus, and this creates a ultra wide lens that has short depth of field, which is essentially, it's like as if you had a 17, you know, 14 millimeter f.1 lens or something goofy, yep. Like that.
And we created some really cool images together just screwing around with it. But the point being, before the interweb came out, you know, we would not maybe have stumbled upon a technique like that somebody stumbled upon and has made it into something. And so just a quick little Google search and boom, there you go. And there's methodology and there's lots and lots of resources out there that if you really want to try, figure something out, it's worth doing.
Yeah. I'm putting the link in the chat for Gavin's later editing efforts.
Oh, that poor guy. Well, yeah. And just to touch on quickly, it's as far as like gear goes, you know, being, having what you need just to do it, or coming into a situation where it's almost like you're playing Titanfall. You know, you're just got loaded down with so much gear. It's like, where do you stop and where does the gear begin? So it's really a fine line to make sure and think ahead. And that's what helps too, with having your gear sorted out ahead of time. And I still have, and this is something I kind of grasped onto when I first started working at the picture place with Barry, was having a gear list. I still do it, even though it's, you know, 21 years into the working in this industry, because, you know, as life gets crazier and crazier, it's always just good to have that in front of you so you can check it. I mean, yes, it's now on the phone, so, you know, I'm advancing with the times a little bit instead of a pad and paper, but yeah, all good points.
Well, and I think that there's also a point where the one distinction that I guess that I will throw out there, in all fairness to we, the animal that are photographers, face it, a lot of us, we're kind of gear junkies, whether we admit it or not. We like this stuff. We're in this professionally because we like photography. We like cameras. We like all of everything that surrounds it, and hopefully we can make some money doing it and whatever. But there's certainly nothing wrong with having some having some pieces of gear that are strictly 100% just for fun or just because we can own them. We have a good friend mutually that is part of our group that just bought himself a Leica M240. This is a $7,000 plus body. It's a 24 megapixel Leica body. It is almost the same size and weight as a Nikon D800 body, but it is, I haven't seen it. None of us have gotten to see it or hold it yet or touch it. Perhaps that day will come, but I think we have to go through some kind of special training and a whole Leica debrief thing. I don't really know, but
we have to become a dentist first.
Yeah, exactly. And I have no doubt that when we hold that camera with that little, you know, pristine, that's the right word there, 50 millimeter lens he has for it, it will truly feel like, wow, this is really great. It will be like, you know, like getting out of your 12-year-old Ford Taurus and jumping into your buddy's brand new BMW. You know, it's going to be that kind of a culture shock of everything about it will feel elegant and well-appointed and just solid and beautifully designed. And he can have it, and he can buy that camera because he can buy that camera. He's a great photographer. He generates income with photography. He can afford that camera. He doesn't need that camera. He can afford it. He can have it. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. The Canon EOS M that Mark kind of got me hooked on last fall is sort of that little camera. It's a lot less expensive than the Leica, so it was, you know.
You could buy approximately 20 EOS M's for that.
Right.
But they both have the M and the AIM.
Exactly, and they're black, and it's really cool.
We should actually put a little 240 after the M on the badge on the camera.
Oh, I think that will be when we see him next fall. I believe our M's will have a 240 on it. We'll work on that. I was going to show you something too, but you know, to have gear that we just like is a really, really great thing. Here is a nifty little piece that this little mount on the this little guy right here, okay? Looky here. This is an old school Canon 50mm 1.4 lens off a circa, you know, 1970s or 80s vintage camera, manual focus, silky smooth, beautiful 1.4 lens. This little mount adapts to my Canon EOS M. I found this crazy mount for just under $13 on the internet. Actually, Sears.com of all places, but why they had this, I have no idea.
That's where you go for your photo gear. When I hear Sears, I just think photography.
But in terms of a gear that's just kind of for fun, this camera represents just that, because now I have this goofy setup, you know, where if I can manage to get this thing mounted on there, right? I now have this really cool setup. I have an inexpensive mirrorless camera, 18 megapixel, really beautiful sensor, with now my old school 50 millimeter lens, pretty cool, and I love it. It's manual focus, big deal. I have manual focus forever. And little Mark Teske, what did you just go and get? Did you mute yourself again,
no,
Mark?
No, I'll tell you what he's saying. I have here. Oh my gosh, look what you did. Is that even right?
That is a Canon, let me back up so you can take this all in.
Wow.
That's a Canon 70-200 2.8 IS version 2 mounted on a $299 Canon EOS M.
Perfect for your pocket.
Perfect for your pocket.
That's the tagline on that thing.
Maybe a case of just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Right.
Hey, I love that. That's one of my favorite things. Thank you.
I will say, Mark, I'm going to go with that's an acceptable thing. When I see people get the iPhone mount for that lens,
that's too far. That's where he draws the line.
Too far.
On that topic, I just my good friend and mentor John Cornforth from the Seattle area just actually bought the new Sony A7R, which for those of you aren't out there, it's an amazing new camera from Sony.
It's kind of a retro styled thing. Everybody's frantically running to their Google box right now. But it is a, what's cool about the Sony a7R is it's a 24 megapixel, I believe, mirrorless camera, and it doesn't have an anti-aliasing filter on it. Kind of like the
D800E.
Yes, exactly. I knew you and I kind of guys would fix me up on that one, but, it's a very kind of boxy, retro-style thing. Gets amazing detail that, and so forth on it. They have a very good Canon adapter from that one, and a bunch of landscape guys are getting amazing results mounting Canon glass on top of that thing. So being that he's, you know, Don's always searching for, again, you know, getting amazing landscape images and trying some new things with it, he picked up a scratch and dent refurbished unit, which... other than a scratch on the box, he can't figure out why it was marked down $300. But it's in perfect shape, so I'm very anxious to hear what he, you know, what he's getting back out of that thing. So.
And I, you know, and again, it comes down to there's nothing wrong with owning gear that you just want to own. I will say though that just out of the sheer responsibility to the industry and to if you are going to enter this as a profession at any level. I think it is important to have some sense of what gear is making you money, what gear maybe should you plan on investing in at some point when you can afford it to enhance your not only your shooting and your capability, but enhance your ability to make money doing it. I think those are all really healthy things. I think right now it seems too many people kind of are going at it backwards. Either they have way more gear than they can ever use and they just don't even know why they have what they have, or they buy gear a little bit on chasing the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, you know, hoping that maybe that gear, that camera, that lens, that whatever. I often bring it right back to, you know, much like an analogy with sporting equipment. Mark, you and I are both skiers, and, you know, face it. You can take somebody who's a very novice at best skier and give them the best skis made, the skis that the top pros in the world ski. It's not going to make them a better skier. It will make them worse. They won't be able to handle the gear. You know, golf, same thing.
Formula One cars, you know, One cars are the most immaculately designed, highest performance cars on the planet. And if you and I got in one, we put it in the fence inside of 10 seconds.
Exactly. And I think so often with camera gear, it's overwhelming, the feature set that is coming into these cameras, the menus, I mean... I'm amazed. I stop at camera stores periodically, and I'll look at some of the gear, and you just start flowing through these menus, and it's mind-numbing how many features they're building into the software in these cameras. You can generally find your way around, but in many cases, I just kind of think, wow, it was just so much simpler and cooler, frankly, when you picked up a camera and your questions were, what's the top shutter speed? Are my lenses all compatible? You know, it has a detachable motor drive. How many frames a second? You know, and these were simpler times. You know, what kind of metering options do I have? And now it's just this, you know, C. But if you have the gear, you better learn how to use it because there's no excuse anymore for people to show up to an event and just blow it because they just simply didn't know how to navigate through their gear, their menus, their whatever. Any other thoughts on that? Or we'll move on.
MoveOn.org.
Moving on,
okay.
Well said, sir.
All right. I am going to, we are going to have one lightning round tonight.
Mini storm.
Yep. And, good one, Dennis. I like that.
I just bought the domain, so don't even try.
Don't even try. You guys, you make me laugh, Dennis.
Well, that's what we're here for, you know, that and to critique your mime routines.
Which is very critiquable, so I like that. My question for the lightning round is simply this. What is the one thing, person, place, or thing, or place, I guess place, person, place, or thing is in there, that you've always wanted to photograph that you haven't had the opportunity to, and realistically, is that ever going to happen? Who wants to go first?
Oh, boy, I'm going to think about this one. So I okay. How many minutes do we get? 30?
Yeah, you get 30 minutes.
Okay.
That's a lightning round right there.
Yeah. This is an untimed lightning round. This is.
Oh, is it really?
This is an untimed lightning discussion because I believe all three of us are capable of being succinct enough in our.
Really? Well, mm-hmm. I just said 30 minutes, so I might have to go later on in the. Oh, boy. I'm thinking, so if someone else wants to go first.
Well, I know what mine is, so I'll throw it in there, and that gives you guys more time to think, too. I already have the date down on the calendar for our solar eclipse. That will be coming up in, how long is it, a couple of years?
I think it's 2017, yeah, so book your hotel rooms now.
Right. And I had the opportunity to photograph a solar eclipse when I was in college. We went to Minot, North Dakota. We found a great spot. We shot some really, really great pictures, except we were really, really stupid college kids, and we have no idea where those negatives are. Okay. I shot some great shots. We dragged a 600 millimeter Canon lens out of shooting Canon film cameras at the time. I do have one awesome picture in totality that all I have left is the picture that ran in the college newspaper that we did a little recap about our trip. It was a crazy, surreal experience. I can hardly wait to shoot it again. I am already thinking about, and you talk about planning for an event. I'm already thinking about some very specific shots and sequences of shots that I want to take when that event comes. So I've got a couple of years to plan this thing out, to have the right gear, the right place, the right everything in place. And then it's a question of executing it, because that's a timed event. It will start, it will happen, and it will be done. No redos, because the next one, it's not like they come around very often.
Yeah, especially total, yeah. Total eclipse.
Yep. And just experiencing it was crazy cool. I definitely see why there's lots of stories of many tribal, nations over the history of the world that freaked out just a little bit when the old sun kind of got blocked there. It's a little creepy. But so there, that is my thing. And I've already kind of danced there once. But like I say, now I'm ready to do it and do it right. Who's going next?
I'll grab the ball. Anybody know who Chris Hadfield is?
No.
Chris Hadfield was the commander of the U.S. or the International Space Station for about 6 months. He's Canadian, and he was the one that had the viral video of him playing David Bowie's Major Tom.
Oh, yes.
Video out of the space station, right? While he was up there, he really looked at his time in space to be a kind of an ambassadorship to Earth to kind of show the things that people can't see every day. So he has this amazing body of work of shots taken from orbit and, shots taken of aurora from above and so forth. And that's kind of my ultimate bucket list. I don't think that one's horribly practical, but shooting from the space station, hey, if we're dreaming about bucket lists, that's at the top. Realistically, though, for me, it's Croatia. You see some of the pictures of Croatia, it's hard to believe that place is on planet Earth. You look at like Piltovice Lakes Park, and you look at some of the nature preserves there. It's a stunningly beautiful place. And just, if you want lush green and blue waters and waterfalls and everything, Croatia's got it all. I recently was able to check off one of my bucket list places just last summer as I went to the Isle of Skye just off of Scotland. And if anybody's looking for a really unbelievable place to nature photograph, the Isle of Skye is really gorgeous as well.
Time.
That was awesome.
You have 28 minutes to spare, so
I'll table it for the next question.
Just so you know, Mark, Dennis and I accept your invitation to go with you to Croatia. Just let us know when our tickets are downloadable. We can't afford it.
Next, we'll super light.
It's not that unreasonable, actually. It's just as expensive as going to Europe. Otherwise, so
we'll carry your luggage.
that one guaranteed will happen. I've almost gone there 3 or 4 times already, so it just hasn't worked out for one thing, one reason or another, but so that one will happen.
Well, the three of us, I'm excited about it. We have it on record. Awesome. Dennis, go.
It'll be fun. I wonder if we can get smoked fish in Croatia.
Oh, plus 5. I'm pretty sure we could get some smoked fish in Croatia. Croatian smoked fish. Oh, boy. I don't know. Still, I've been thinking this whole time, and I like berries. Berries is good. You know, that I really enjoy astrophotography, as many people probably know who have been listening to this for the last 5-6 years. So I like timed events like that. I really enjoyed photographing the transit of Venus, which was in 2012, I believe, which is where Venus goes between the sun and Earth, and I think it happens like once every 120 something years. So I'm a big fan of photographing things that, especially when they're able to predict like that, whether it be an eclipse or a transit of a planet or something like that. That's very fun because you get that one chance, and then once it's done until the next time it comes around. I do hope that I can photograph Halley's Comet next time it comes around, which is going to be, it's still not for a while. I think it's 2050 maybe. And by then I don't think I'll even have to take a camera out. I'll just be able to just, you know, record it with my eyes and then get it printed at Kinko's. Mm-hmm. Can you do that yet? No,
I think you can. Yeah.
All right.
There's an app for that.
I actually tried on Google Glass today. I tried on a pair of Google Glass today. So you're kind of there. It was interesting.
I want to change my answer. I want a photo. I want to do a portrait of you wearing your Google glasses.
You had about a 2-minute window to do that, and that there's a timed event for you.
Oh, yeah, but otherwise, I don't really have any other. I mean, there's a million other beautiful places on this planet that I have not even begun to even photograph. So I could be busy until the day I die photographing this place. It's so wonderful.
All right. I think that's just fun, and I think it's fun to just throw that stuff out there. We've enjoyed some of the shooting we get to do up in the North Shore.
Oh.
Clearly the ice caves that you mentioned earlier that are kind of a natural wonder right now that are quite the spectacle are very tempting for those of us that live within a few hours of that, but the sheer crowd mass that is now showing up there is making this insanely crazy. I can't imagine doing it. I wouldn't go up there on a weekend. I'm working all the time anyway, but when that's only part of the problem. But I certainly wouldn't want to go up there with thousands of other people troopsing around that have no interest there. But, boys, like, you know, the shot you mentioned, the Bill did, it'd be really fun to get up there and really get it at just the right time. But that would be cool. Let's just do a quick pick segment, and then we'll move on and call this thing a night. We've kind of interjected a few things throughout the discussion. I'm going to start the picks with – I've kind of been in search of the right combination of phone case. I'm not a big case guy. I'm Dennis and I are very much alike in that the sheer beauty of an iPhone in particular, the fit and finish and the way it feels in your hand without a case is really, really great. However – in realistic use in my life, I'm in a lot of places, a lot of times in and out of schools and teams and gyms and rinks and everywhere. I just have too many things. So I've been kind of in search of a case, and I've tried several that I just didn't like, and I finally found one. It's a case made by Spec. Okay? It has a really slick little slot back here that you can put in, like a credit card or two and a license if you want. I, however, have found this little guy. This was a Black Friday deal, okay? It was 70% off with free shipping. It is a credit card-sized USB charger for my phone. And this little guy, they sell this for $25. It's made by, it's called Charge Card. Charge Card. They also sell a key fob version of this. But now this very conveniently slides right inside the back of my case. So at all times, I have a charger and a nice case that's not bulky and thick with my phone all the time. Super, super happy with this setup. I don't run my phone dead very often, but there are times where I'm out for long periods of time. I only have to charge this phone usually once every couple of days. But in the event I'm running low, I mean, a USB port, you can find them everywhere. Your laptop, somebody else's laptop, TVs at Costco all have USB ports. They're everywhere if you start looking for them. So that's my power user tip for the night. Very fancy, very nice. Who else has got something?
I'm going to go down a different path. Kind of, I'm going to riff off of your know your gear, know how to use it thing. And my pick of the week is good training. And I'm not talking about, you know, workshop of the month or something like that. I'm talking about, you know, spend the $39 a month or whatever for lynda.com or Kelby Training or something like that. And, you know, sit down at night and watch that instead of watching Honey Boo Boo or something like that.
Or Sister Act 2.
Or Sister Act 2. It's amazing how much information is out there. You know, it's I do it all the time because I constantly – some new video tool I need to learn and I need to become an expert on it fast. So I'll just pop out there and bam, something on lynda.com. I spend a couple hours hitting the high points and suddenly I'm productive in it. So, you know, if you haven't used that already, check it out because there is, you know, whether it's operating your camera or how to edit a documentary or how to use Photoshop or how do you, you know, how to sell prints, all of those things are out there. Just start dumpster diving.
Perfect.
Cool.
So my tip of the week, learn something.
That's a good tip.
It sounds obvious, but I've seen some pictures on the internet where people could really take that advice and learn something. I'm just saying. My pick, I just kind of looked through my Amazon here and saw what I have purchased that actually relates to photography of late. And you can tell we're kind of all in that, that kind of spot in our career of photography where we're not, you know, buying the newest lenses and camera bodies. We're pretty comfortable with our gear that we have at the moment. And so it's just kind of finding those little gadgets and things that kind of help you do your job a little bit easier. The thing that I found recently was a Bestech 110 volt for the car, the power inverter. I had one like a while ago, like 3 years ago, and couldn't find it. So I found this guy here. And this one's nice because it does have, aside from the two plugins that it has, it also has two USB slots, one for iPad and one for iPhone or however you, you know, want to do that. But it's slick. It's red, $27. Just, I mean, you don't realize, especially in the cold weather like this, when you've got camera batteries that die a little quicker, when you're out, like, say, I don't know, doing video of skiing and it's really cold and you need some weight. For example, just pulling that out of random. It's a nice thing to have so you can, you know, fire up the car, warm them up, your fingers and toes, and also be charging your batteries on the fly if you need to. So that's the best tech. I'll put it in the show notes. You guys can pick that or check that out if you are in the need for something like that.
I will say the EOS M is what I'm using to do all my weekend, all my video work, and I spend all day outside with that thing.
How does the battery work?
I only go through two batteries the entire day. I switch at lunch, and that's enough to get me through the entire day. That sounds amazing,
wow.
But
yeah,
I know. It makes no sense at all, but it does an amazing job. I think it goes to sleep pretty aggressively, and I think that helps battery life quite a bit. But yeah, even out in sub-zero cold, I really only, you know, I get 2 to 3 hours of video filming out of a battery. That's not constant, but just kind of running around and shooting clips and so forth.
Yeah. Well, what I found with my D600 battery from doing photographing the kids' snowmobile races that I do, to be out on the lake, which is pretty much as exposed as you can be for about, let's see, it's around, usually around 7 or 8 hours, not doing any video. Maybe a few clips here or there, about 10, 15 seconds. Otherwise, it's all stills. And I could just barely get the one day on one battery. Like, it gets closer towards the end. So, and I found that, you know, just keeping hand warmers in the camera bag, you know, if there's ever a break in the action. But it's so close that, you know, right in there. And that's what temperature is usually around 0 Fahrenheit to about 20 Fahrenheit. It can usually last about that long. So,
you know, that's kind of a random pick of the week too. They actually, that the little charcoal activated heat hand warmers, they make a foot version of those that are sticky,
Yes.
You can just take and stick that thing onto your battery and just leave it hanging on there in your pocket, and it'll just keep the thing warm, giving you a lot more battery life.
Yep. All the things we do up here in this climate, right?
Yep. Everybody in Los Angeles just went, huh.
And everybody in Alaska went, big babies.
Yep. Well, so, could always it's funny. I went to the – I attended an outdoor University of Minnesota Golden Gopher hockey game at outdoor stadium on campus, which was sort of a novelty that they did some outdoor games. And I believe it was something in the neighborhood of like 26 below when we got there for game time. Add a little wind. Trust me, people were bundled up. And I didn't take many pictures, but I had my EOSN with me and my phone. And it was hilarious because even trying to keep all that stuff as close to your body as you could, it was still an adventure to keep enough battery power and those crazy things to function and grab any shots. But that was definitely this is a Minnesota thing. Why are we all here? There's 43,000 people out here, 25 below zero watching a hockey game. What are we thinking? But it is, we do crazy things up here in this time of the world, but we have to do something in the cold weather. So, all right. Anybody else have any other picks they want to throw in, or we're going to wrap this thing up?
I'm good. I'll have more next time probably, because usually in the spring I start to gear up and that's never good.
Well, I think we all kind of go through that. Well, this has been just kind of a fun little break in the action. Our regular host, Gavin Syme, is a busy lad these days. He's you can find him at callmegav.com and learn about his race for the Brick congressional seat in the state of Washington, among everything else he's doing. So he was happy to step aside and let us just run with the show, as long as we didn't totally crash this thing into the ground tonight. So I think we kept the wings, the wheels underneath us, I think, for the most part, so that's good. But the show is sponsored always by SimeFX.com. That's Gavin's Lightroom preset business and his training videos and so on. Mark, where can folks find you?
You can find me. I've got right in my lower third down there for those watching video. For those on audio, www.markteskyarchitecture.com. And Teskey is spelled T-E-S-K-E-Y. For some reason,
why? Because he says so.
The key to spelling Teskey is with a K-E-Y.
K-E-Y, that's him.
Uh-huh. And,
M-O-U-S-E.
Twitter at Mark Teskey, Facebook at Mark Teskey Photography, and Google Plus at Mark Teskey Architecture. All over the place, so look me up.
All right, Dennis?
DZPicks.com.
Simple. Got that Twitter handle yet?
At DZPicks. that's all I got. Well, before we forget, don't close it down just yet after we sign off, because I have a question from a listener, and it should be good. It has to do with Seattle Filmworks question and advanced photo system question. So we'll tackle
Seattle
those.
Well, that'll be in the immediate after show.
We sign off.
We will give him an answer to that question.
Oh, we'll give him an answer, all right.
Oh, boy, will we ever. And, and I can just find me at pictureplace.com. My Twitter handle is fstop95. I don't know why I've kept that, but that's my thing. I got my first real live email account in 1995, so I stuck my stake in the ground and said, I'm sticking with this. So that's my legacy piece. This has been a fun little group. The three of us have had a chance to be together a few times. That's always fun. We need to do that more often and stop this whole working thing. But it's been fun to just kind of run with this thing a little bit tonight. We'll officially call this show a wrap here. Thank you, gentlemen, for your contributions. We will look forward to doing this again. Who knows? Maybe the congressman. What do we call him? Congressional candidate.
Call me Gav. Call him Gav.
Call him Gav.
He always will be our Gav, no matter how far he goes. You know.
He will be our Gav. No, that's just too good. So, in any event, you may see our mugs again or some variation of it in the future. So, at this point, we'll call this a wrap. And in 15 seconds after this ends, we will answer the Seattle Filmworks
question. Oh, it's a real good one.
Thank you, everybody. Everybody wave bye.
Sounds good. Bye, everybody.
Bridge wave. All right. Okay, we're done. Okay, so Seattle Filmworks, huh? That would be Kodak 5247 was the official name of that film.
Did you really know that?
Do you know why? Do you know one of the biggest risks to that film was that it was very susceptible to scratching, and do you know why? Because it lacked what?
Scratch tolerance.
It lacked the anti-halation ramjet backing. I'm not kidding. I knew.
Do you actually? Are you looking at like some sort of Wikipedia page? Oh, that's great.
From my photo finishing days, I do.
That's right. So Patrick has a question. He's wondering, hey guys, I just found a big box full of Seattle Filmworks canisters. What should I do?
Make a wreath.
Okay, I will let him know that. But apparently it looks like they're not around anymore.
Who would have ever guessed?
So I think you're going to – we don't know, Patrick.
Can somebody brief me in on this one?
Oh, Seattle Filmworks.
Right. Oh, that's right. This is Mark, who never shot a film camera.
Okay, here was the deal. Here was my experience working with Seattle Filmworks when I was working in a photo lab. People would bring it in, and we had to tell them, oh, no, you have to send that back to Seattle Filmworks. Like, it was some sort of unique process where if you were to run it in our machines, it would totally...
It was not a C41 film.
Okay.
So
their own formula or whatever?
Well, okay, here's the rest of the story, because I know.
Well, enlighten Patrick. I mean, I got all mine done processed before they went out of business. So just trying to help a guy out.
You were lucky. And by the way, Sundance Photo that used to be in Milwaukee also was able to process that. Could have gotten.
It's not called Milwaukee Filmworks.
I know. Kodak 5247, it truly was made by Kodak, but it was made for the motion picture industry. And somewhere along the lines, somebody realized that when they would go to shoot a movie, let's say the first Die Hard, that would have been about the right vintage, okay? They would spool up plenty of film because the last thing that they wanted to do, they would not run the risk of changing emulsions partway through producing the film, shooting the film, because with emulsion changes came slight shifts in color, possibly. So they would buy these massive bulk rolls of film and begin shooting their movie. When they were done shooting all their movie, they had leftover film in a given emulsion. Somewhere along the line, somebody knew somebody, and Seattle Filmworks bought this remnant unexposed spooled 35 millimeter frame film, because that's what ran through the movie cameras. And then they repackaged it, put it in special little film cartridges, and then began marketing it as free film. And they would literally send you a free roll of film or a postcard for a free roll, or they put ads in Good Housekeeping, free film. And they would send you free film, which seemed like an awful good deal. And then people would shoot it. And then, they would have to send it back to Seattle Filmworks. And that they would then, they were the first company that also then offered, you would be able to get prints and or slides at the same time, very inexpensively. And at the time, the photo finishing stores and the photo labs would charge a lot of money to go from negatives to slides. So it was kind of a nice feature for people. And people would freak out because they would come into the lab that Dennis worked at, or some of the retailers that our lab that I was working for would service. And they'd say, what do you mean you can't process this? It's Kodak film. You have Kodak all over the place. I'm sorry, man, we cannot process this film. If you ran that film through C41 process, it literally would come up blank. So
yeah, that was when they really freaked out. They freaked out a little bit when you told me you had to send it to somewhere else. Right. Then they really freaked out when you said that, here's why all your pictures are gone.
Right. And so it was an interesting marketing gimmick. The film was, it was never really intended to be shot in still cameras. So
yeah,
the results were what they were. I mean, I saw some pictures from them that were pretty decent, and most of them were pretty, whatever. But it was more a marketing gimmick than anything else. But the fact that it was never intended to be spooled that tightly, it was very susceptible to scratching. There you go.
Someone stuck around, and they just got a whole bunch of wisdom on Seattle Film Works. Mm-hmm. And then his other question was,
I've been madly googling, and I've discovered that there's a company out there called Swan Photo Labs that says if your local lab has discontinued processing film, use Swan Photo Labs. We develop all types of film, including Kodak, Fuji, and Seattle Film Works.
Patrick, we found you. Mark, bravo. Another plus five. You're up to 10 already.
SwanPhotoLabs.com.
That's fantastic. Now, this one here, this is a bit trickier. This is all film. This is all film related. This guy, Patrick, it looks like he's a big film shooter, or he used to be. Now, he's also shooting APS, which is the advanced photo. No, come on now. Barry, hold it together. Now, Patrick is also an avid APS or advanced photo system shooter. Is anybody shooting APS these days?
This seems like something Larry would have been really into at some point in the past.
Larry would no. This is not up Larry's alley. What this is this, and bravo, Patrick, for still shooting this. What this allows him to do is, how like when you shoot 35 millimeter and you just like it just takes boring 2-to-3 ratio like pictures, right? And it's like you can't do anything else. Well, what this system does is it lets you interchange, so you can actually put the film in and you can change what ratio. There was the C for classic, and then there was also a panoramic mode, which shot into 1-to-3 ratio. And then there was also, 16 by 9,
yep.
Mm-hmm. Which was called, I think, like an HD kind of version.
Mm-hmm. And let me address that from the wholesale photo finishers standpoint that serviced a lot of these retailers.
And then I'll hit you with his specific question.
Okay. So imagine the shock that little Mrs. Johnson has when she gets her shiny new APS camera. She takes her little trip to Hawaii. She discovers she's very excited about this because she's flipping that switch and she's shooting panoramics and 16 by 9s and she's doing all sorts of fun stuff.
Yep.
She comes back to her local little photo retailer to pick up her pictures, expecting to pay her normal $6.99 a roll because that's what she always paid for double prints.
Nope.
And the bill is $64.
Oh, what do you mean you printed 36 4x11 panos?
Exactly. So how else can we be of assistance to Patrick?
Oh, that was his main question, is he was wondering, hey, I might have shot some on pano. Is there a way to just do like the classic? So I think there's a way. No? Just tell him no?
You can't take the idiot out of an exposed roll.
He could make a 4x6 out of that 4x11, right? Theoretically. I mean, theoretically. As long as it's people aren't on the edges.
Right. Well, that's true. That's very true.
What do you got, Mark? You're digging. You're learning so much tonight about film. It's unreal.
You're muted. Mark, you're muted.
As I just discovered, Swan Photo Labs will process APS film as well today.
Swan Photo Labs! We have to get sponsor the show, I guess.
That's a double shout-out, Swan.
Wow!
Give me some of that money.
All right, so Patrick, if you happen to find a few rolls of APS in the drawer with your other Seattle Filmworks, just looks like Swan Photo can help you out. And I hope that helps your question, but it's fun to see people still shooting film.
Larry says thanks for the shout out.
Oh. Well,
thank you for Larry just ignoring the rest of us.
Yeah, that's fine.
I think he was reacting to me commenting that he might be an APS shooter.
Oh, I think he's very offended, perhaps, but this is what it is.
You know Leica made something of shot APS at some point in history.
Um,
mm, No.
Have you seen the system yet, Mark?
I have seen a Leica plastic point and shoot camera before. They did make
it. How was it? Well, how was it spelled? L-I-K?
Yeah, it was real Leica, real L-E-I-C.
Was it really?
Oh, yeah. Oh. It was a real Leica, but it was plainly, it was a plastic point and shoot camera. And it was a Leica. So, you know, yeah, absolutely. Those do exist. And I'm sure, I don't know what they go for, but not every Leica is fully Leica. Like, actually, a bunch of the low, you know, there's some low-end Leicas that are actually rebadged Panasonics.
So the thing we learned is, if there's a K in Leica, it's probably not the real version. No, but to be honest, Patrick is an old coworker, and we used to both work in the photo finishing lab. So he threw out some random questions, and he brought back all the old memories of the advanced photo system in Seattle Filmworks interactions with customers who totally understood what was going on. So I just had to bring those up for fun. It's the after show, right?
Okay, quick Google Leica Mini, L-E-I-C-A Mini. And you'll see it's a plastic.
Oh, I remember the point and shoot. I remember that camera. That is fantastic. I'm going to be owning a Leica soon.
That would be great if we all showed up with our own Leica. I got one too.
Yeah, we're all rolling with Leicas.
By the way, he's. Larry's actually listening and sniping at us during this conversation. So
no, I did not see any reaction.
He's sniping at you, so you're like the middleman translator. Dear Larry.
For the listeners, that this is so enlightening for, Larry's our fellow Leica lover that just picked up the M240. So a few jokes at his expense are only mandatory.
Exactly. We're jealous. We can't wait to see the camera in real life.
Right. Yeah, that's truthful. We're actually all jealous of it and really can't wait to steal it from him.
Just borrow. I don't think he's going to let us touch it.
No.
That's the problem.
He'll probably make us try out a mini first, and if we behave, like, don't drop it and behave well with it, we'll get to look at the other one. That's all I got. I'm glad we were able to answer his Patrick's questions. I don't know if you guys have any topics that you like, any like topics as important as those I touched on. Over.
Not really. I just have a poster I need to work on.
Oof. You know what's bad when your microphone can cover up the actual camera that's attached to your lens. That's how you know it's a teeny tiny camera.
But Mark, truly, aren't you really just compensating for something with that lens on that?
That.
All right.
And I wanted to know.
I didn't think we were going to make it awkward, but at the very last minute there, we did. So I have to change the rating to E.
It's E for everyone.
There's got to be a way we can torpedo a congressional career here quick before we sign out, isn't there?
Well, we're all climbing over, you know, when he makes it all the way to Pennsylvania Avenue, I mean, one of us has to be the White House photographer, so I'm just saying, it's going to be a lot of competition.
You can take the pictures, I'll photobomb.
Oh, you like, hey, you want to be the House videographer?
There we go. Yeah, perfect.
Perfect. I think we have this. We're figuring it out. It's fantastic.
Looks like you guys have jobs. That's cool. I'll just kind of hang out. And
well, you're going to be
I'll get him coffee.
You're the outdoor White House astro.
No, that's not even a thing. There is so much light pollution in D.C. Don't even get me started.
Oh, but listen, when you're up, well, you can have the military clear the airspace and then shut all the power grids down, so you have dark. All it takes is one presidential order. Boom. Done.
I would like you to shut down all the power in the city.
Just a Southern Democrat.
I'm just a Southern Democrat.
Mark, have you gotten hooked on House of Cards yet?
Oh, yes, I have. And be careful. I've only seen episode one of season two, so no spoilering.
Okay.
Bruce Willis is dead the whole time.
He's in it? Holy smokes.
Oh, I forgot he wasn't in it yet by the first episode. Man. Sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. There's still lots more to see, so I didn't ruin the whole thing. I mean, I didn't even mention, you know, when Weird Al Yankovic gets in it. Oh,